Well, yesterday, Jim Smirko was one of our guests here on Current State. Mr. Smirko was approved unanimously, according to Eric Lacey of the Lansing State Journal, approved unanimously as the city of Lansing's next city attorney, quoting here from comments that he told the council before the unanimous vote, "I think I will bring transparency and trust to the office. I don't want to dwell on the past. I want to move forward." Jim Smirka becoming the city attorney for his third Lansing mayor. He was an attorney under both Tony Benavides and Dave Hollister between 1994 and 2004. Lots to address in the city attorney's office. You can revisit and learn more in case you missed that segment, our interview with Jim Smirka at WKAR.org. Just follow the links to Current State and you are there. Glad you could join us here today. I'm Mark Bayshore. Michigan voters approved the use of medical marijuana back in 2008, but in those 8 years, many local municipalities have struggled to craft laws to govern the booming dispensary industry. In Lansing, the city council's working on a new ordinance it hopes to review in about 3 weeks. There's also an effort underway to legalize marijuana for recreational use in Michigan. The group MI Legalize is trying to put a measure on the November ballot. That project seems stalled, however, as state elections officials say the group's not collected enough valid signatures. In the meantime, a unique development has occurred here in Lansing, and Current State's Kevin Lavery is here to tell us about it. Kevin, how did you spend your Sunday?
Well, Mark, I went to church twice. My own, of course, and I also attended the first service of the brand-new First Cannabis Church of Logic and Reason. They want to promote a message that marijuana has many good benefits, and they're hoping to overturn negative opinions about it in the community. So I decided to see for myself how this new congregation is taking shape.
South Lansing, Sunday afternoon. Most of the mainstay churches in the neighborhood have wrapped up their morning worship services. But just off Martin Luther King Boulevard, a new assembly is congregating for the very first time. There's a cross on a sign in the window of this decidedly unorthodox temple. But it's not the globally revered symbol of Christianity. This cross is green. The official incense burned at the First Cannabis Church of Logic and Reason is marijuana. As the parking lot starts to fill with curious attendees, the pastor appears near the entrance. The Reverend Jeremy Hall is from Jackson, 34, with a thick brown beard, royal blue shirt, and black vest. He's ready for my key question. What makes smoking pot a spiritual experience?
We just feel that it is a tool that we can use to increase our spirituality. The analogy that we like to use is that you don't need running shoes to go running, but it certainly helps. You don't need cannabis to be spiritual. It's not a requirement, but we feel that it adds a special layer to our togetherness as a family, that it breaks down all of these preconceived barriers and notions of what we may believe and open us up to maybe different ways of thinking and viewing the world around us.
Hall has high hopes for his inaugural service. The First Cannabis Church of Logic and Reason already has some 1,200 Facebook followers. At first, he expected about 40 people to attend, but Hall says with all the media attention they've garnered as of late, the crowd could be twice that size. Marijuana has had a turbulent history in Lansing. Ever since Michigan voters approved it for medical use in 2008, the city has struggled to create laws that efficiently and fairly regulate the booming dispensary scene. One such ordinance passed in 2013 allows anyone over age 21 to consume medical marijuana on private property. Reverend Hall says that's why his church chose the Lansing Herbal Farmers Market as its venue.
And so this event today, Reverend, is specifically for people who are medical marijuana card holders?
Not specifically, no. Only those who have cards will be allowed to consume cannabis on premises. In the city of Lansing, we have by ballot initiative in 2013 an ordinance that allows anybody over the age of 21 to consume cannabis on private property. This event is being held on private property, but so that we can ease any of the fears that the city may have, we are restricting the cannabis consumption to cardholders at the moment, just so that we can work with everybody. We're not trying to have this initiative killed before it even begins.
Inside, Bob Marley wails from a portable speaker. The reggae legend might be the closest thing to a patron saint this self-declared agnostic church has. In one room, folding chairs are arrayed in preparation for the Reverend's sermon. Through the door, cannabis clouds waft in the air. Steve Green co-owns the Lansing Herbal Farmers Market. He wants his business to be a hub where patients and caregivers can explore products and treatment options together. Green thinks the proliferation of medical marijuana dispensaries in Lansing is changing old attitudes about the drug.
I think overall the climate is they see the stigma decreasing as they've seen like a Sanjay Gupta special or something like that on TV, and it becomes more to the community talking. You know, my parents have had the talk now with their friends and stuff like that, and so the talk has gone further now than ever before.
Do you think Michigan is destined to go the way of Alaska, Oregon, Washington State, Colorado?
I think as long as we follow common sense, we are. The people here are ready for it, and there's a large group pushing for it.
In the hazy medication room, Chris shows off a few of his wares. He's opted not to reveal his last name. On the table in front of him sits a large bowl of barbecue sauce made with medicated honey. You might call this BBQ a la THC. Before he got into the cannabis industry, Chris came from the culinary world. His was a profession laden with strict standards. He says it was disheartening to find marijuana not so well regulated. He wants to bring more quality control and clarity to the industry.
Do you feel that you're on pretty safe legal grounds doing this?
Well, the way I'm going about this is I'm taking this as a strictly industrial approach. So I'm not making any revenue from the direct sales of marijuana. So this is truly about educating and providing the best possible ways of going about things. The problem with the past regulations and all these things has been they've been trying to just cover it all with a blanket. Truly, this industry is a tree with many distinct branches that are just could go off forever on their own. So trying to cover it and leave it up to a dispensary owner to regulate what they think is it, you should not have anything on your shelf that you do not fully understand what the product is.
Chris's cannabis cuisine goes far beyond brownies. He says he can safely medicate just about any food you might think of. He's found a way to blend his two passions.
Seeing someone's face light up from tasting some chocolate mousse or seeing someone's face light up from tasting lemon custard, and then not to mention the fact that this is also going to be used to alleviate pain. I've had my favorite example is I had a man who had severe spinal pinching at an event up in Clio. I did medicated coffees, and he drank two of those and was almost crying, saying, like, I've never felt this much pain relief. I've never been out of this much, but still be able to function, which truly that alone is its own reward. So I can make good food, and I love my truly my first passion's food and culinary. I love making people's faces light up because of that. But truly, my second passion is this cannabis industry, and I want to bring it all together and help it all become a reputable, positive industry.
The smoke clears, and the congregants find their chairs. It's time for Reverend Hall to preach the gospel of grass. He's quick to acknowledge the suspicions others may have of his new enterprise.
The biggest question that I get is, how can this be a church if we don't subscribe to a religious theology? If I'm not sitting here preaching from a book, if I don't have prophets that told us how to behave, how can we call ourselves a church? Well, the reality is it just sounded better than cannabis cult. No, just totally kidding. Our ideal of a church is that we are simply a collection of like-minded individuals coming under one roof, united by a common cause. And our current cause right now is our belief in cannabis and its use in our spirituality. You can consume cannabis and still believe in God. You can still believe in Allah. You can believe in reincarnation. You can believe in whatever you want and still consume cannabis. It's something that brings us together.
Rhonda Fuller doesn't see it that way. She came with a picket sign in hand to protest the church's presence in her community. As a former alternative education professional, Fuller says she's seen the effect marijuana can have on the most impressionable of our society.
What's most concerning are the children who are influenced by what adults do. But we have created adult-centered culture, and they're going to do what they want to do, what pleases them, what their desires are. The children be damned. It only benefits those who advocate it, who produce it, and who sell it. That's all. They're the pushers. and they're the only ones who benefit from drugs. You tell me anybody who has benefited, who's gone on and made a great life from use of drugs, including marijuana.
Fuller says Michigan should pay close attention to how recreational marijuana plays out in the four states that have legalized it, Alaska, Washington, Oregon, and Colorado. An effort to place recreational marijuana on the Michigan ballot this November is temporarily on hold after state elections officials deem some of the petition signatures to be invalid. Back inside, a lady near the back questions Reverend Hall about the absence of a prayer during the service. The First Cannabis Church openly asserts its agnostic doctrine, but Hall says he'll take it under consideration. Later, I ask Jen Spaulding about her inquiry.
To be a church, you got to come together. You know, it's all faiths, it's all people. And finding a way to stomp that middle ground with a prayer that will just fit everybody is going to take some time.
Is there such thing as a prayer that fits everyone?
I think there is. We say hello, we say I love you, and that's universal.
Spaulding is not yet an official member of First Cannabis, but she's a believer. She's an Army veteran and a cancer survivor. Nerve damage has confined her to a wheelchair, and her stomach and kidneys are failing. Maybe it's the faith her parents instilled in her that keeps her going, something Spaulding had to reconcile for herself.
My parents are Catholic, taught me three things: love your country, love your family, pot is the devil. You know, and that's the way it was. So I never knew anything about this until someone said, hey, you need to try this. You're dying. These medications are killing you. You can't get out of bed. You don't know who your kids are. You look at all these prescriptions they got you on. At one time, I was on 120 different medications in a 7-month time span. 120. All gone. I don't use any pharma medications anymore, not even for a headache.
The First Cannabis Church of Logic and Reason is already making plans for a future in Lansing. For starters, Reverend Hall is passing out Pay It Forward cards for his members to bestow on those whom they've performed a random act of kindness. The church hopes to track these good deeds as they spread into the community. Jen Spaulding has much to be thankful for. She'll be back.
These people brought me into their life, and it was such a joy. So I'm looking forward to coming back.
As the church claims its foothold in Lansing, the city continues work on a new, more comprehensive medical marijuana ordinance. A previous draft written in April failed because it was deemed unenforceable. Now, with a new city attorney at the helm, the Lansing City Council hopes to have a new ordinance ready for review by July 22nd. For Current State, I'm Kevin Lavery.
And coming up on Current State, last week Great Lakes governors voted to allow the city of Waukesha, Wisconsin to draw more than 1 million gallons of water daily from Lake Michigan. Also, President Obama signed a pipeline safety bill that will impact the 63-year-old line running through the Straits of Mackinac, Enbridge's Line 5. We'll recap June's environmental news with journalist commentator Gary Wilson on the way. It's Current State on 90.5 WKAR, always at WKAR.org. Since its early days in the mid-19th century, photography's been crucial to how we see ourselves and the world we live in. The Grand Rapids Art Museum showcases two centuries of photographic landscapes, portraits, novelties, and experimental works in its new exhibit, Mirror Memory. Mirror memory refers to the term the mirror with a memory, which was coined to describe photography's ability to capture and keep an image for all time. WKAR's Peter Wharf met with Chief Curator Ron Platt at the museum last week to view and discuss a few of the photos. They began with a shot of early 20th century cutting-edge technology at a New York Central railway yard.
With the steam locomotive, and it just looks so antiquated and so quaint, and yet when that photograph was made, what you were looking at was like a portrait of technology at its most contemporary, and it was a very, very sort of dynamic picture.
I love the iconic shot here, the Flatiron Building. It is iconic New York City, turn of the century. And as I look closer and closer through the mist and the detail of the trees, you can even see this sort of reflective light off of the pavement that you see in every movie nowadays in a night scene.
That's the thing about a great photographic print, is that you see like amazing detail. And I think for this photograph, actually in particular, you really zeroed in on one where I think the technique is really important, because you have this iconic building, the Flatiron Building in 1905, and then you feel like you know that piece of architecture. And I think it just makes it look very odd here. And
it almost looks like a painting.
Surreal. Well, it does feel like a painting, and part of that is that the tree really sets the stage for it, this sort of like sort of exploratory growth of this branch that seems to be still sort of like reaching out as you're looking at it. And it gives a sort of an odd sort of warping to the building behind it, and that is added to by the sort of the reflection and that sort of distortion of the imagery in the water in the foreground.
We're speaking with Ron Platt. He's chief curator at the Grand Rapids Art Museum, and we're walking through a little bit of Mirror Memory, which is a photographic exhibit from the permanent collection through August 21st. You're pointing exactly to what I was hoping we would be speaking about next, and this is Jacques-Henri Lartigue.
Really one of my favorite European photographers of the early 20th century. And mid-20th century, actually, but I think he brought such a joy of life to his work, and he had a sense that sort of our everyday moments could be, and in some ways were, the most iconic moments of our life, that you didn't need to be showing the sort of penultimate moment of something, that these moments of sort of everyday activity, where people were engaging in activities with one another, and of course motion and movement were his sort of preoccupations. And so I selected a group of images and sort of arranged them like this to sort of suggest the movement between all of the works.
I love the way you have these two here with the glider, you know, sort of Wright Brothers type contraption taking off from the sand dune, and right across, what's this guy doing? He's got his dog taking off from his own hand over a canal or a ditch or something.
That's a dog that enjoys being in the water.
He looks like he does.
That's fantastic. And then just like you put those in context with something where it's just people walking on the beach, and you see that his preoccupation with movement and then the image, and how there is sort of like something he's going for, where the sort of image, the composition kind of locks together. It's what I think these pictures really demonstrate, what makes him so special and fantastic.
We're looking at a couple of groups of portraits next here. Two famous photographs from your collection, Pablo Casals and Winston Churchill. And tell us about the artist, the photographer.
I think Karsh had a remarkable capacity for sort of capturing character in unusual and iconic ways. And he, you know, he was someone that was greatly celebrated during his lifetime, and so he got remarkable commissions and had access to just about anybody who needed to be photographed or who he wanted to photograph. But I juxtaposed these two pictures because I just wanted to, again, sort of demonstrate how there's like not one kind of particular Karsh image, that it was really, he was trying to sort of telegraph something about the character of the individual. So you, here you have one of the, you know, 20th century's great statesmen, and so he's sort of like, you know, in this sort of like very open position, sort of looking directly at the camera and just like sort of ready to engage.
Yeah.
And he also looks like he's been through a few rounds. I don't mean a drink. I mean, he's sort of been through the wars of public service.
Yeah, it's an intense photo.
It's a very intense
and just
photo.
It just defines mm-hmm. Churchill. But so does this one too, of Casals, who's back is to the camera,
yeah.
And he's
yeah.
reaching out with.
So this portrait of Pablo Casals, the great cellist, I think is remarkable too, because here you have sort of like a quintessential idea of the sort of the artist in their garret, if you will. So he's sort of in this rehearsal room. He's like, there's barely a source of light here. He's practicing with no sort of engagement with the photographer, and therefore no engagement with the viewer. It's just him and his cello. And in what I suspect probably was a room he liked to rehearse in, because it would have amazing acoustics in this sort of open space.
Another American artist over here, and you have a real historic span and also something very timely, too, from Gordon Parks.
Well, yeah, unfortunately, it is timely. I guess this show was up for maybe a week before Ali died, and I mean, for a lot of us, he was a really important figure, and I think for Parks, he was a really important figure. He photographed him innumerable times in lots of conditions. And you know, another thing about photography and portraiture is subjects need to trust the photographer to represent them in a way that's not going to embarrass them or make them look silly. And so Parks had such access to Ali because Ali recognized a sort of kinship with Parks. I think they had very similar ideas about what it was like to be a black person in the United States in the middle part of the 20th century, when it was particularly charged racially here in the U.S. And I think in Ali, Parks found someone who was just a complicated, amazing, just magnetic presence. I mean, who wouldn't want to photograph Muhammad Ali? And this was the photograph that the New York Times ran for their obituary, and I've seen it numerous times. In some ways, it is sort of the iconic Ali image.
Ron Platt is chief curator at the Grand Rapids Art Museum, and we've been talking a little bit about Mirror Memory, fantastic exhibit of photography now through August 21st at the Grand Rapids Art Museum. Ron, thanks very much.
Oh, my pleasure. I appreciate your interest, and it's great to see people in here enjoying our collection.
For Current State, this is Peter Wharf.
And coming up on Current State, we will attend the retirement party of Maestro Carolyn Sherrill. After 26 years with the Meridian Concert Band, she'll be retiring next month after her few final Independence Day concerts across mid-Michigan. That and more coming up after the break on Current State. Well, it's only Tuesday, and already this week on WKAR's Current State, we've heard from the incoming City of Lansing attorney, Jim Smirtka. We've heard from skeptics about non-certified teachers in Detroit classrooms and maybe elsewhere in Michigan as well. We've heard about Lansing's new cannabis church, and we've heard a bunch more. If it's important to you to hear stories like this on a radio station that is enriching and intelligent, please consider a donation to WKAR. Our programming is different. It's extraordinary. It's better. It's smarter. You can support extraordinary programming with a sustaining gift by using the Give Now button at WKAR.org. And if you're already doing that, we thank you. The long-awaited decision about Waukesha Water wasn't the only environmental story making news here in June. In Washington, President Obama signed into law a measure creating stricter pipeline standards. That move impacts energy infrastructure here in the Great Lakes. For this month's Great Lakes Month in Review, we welcome environmental journalist and commentator back, Gary Wilson. Hi, Gary.
Good morning, Mark. Good to be back with you. And before we get into these matters, a cannabis church, did I hear that right?
We did. We had a cannabis church service, Lansing's first that we're aware of here just over the weekend, and Kevin Lavery attended and kind of took everybody there to what happened. So
okay, I'll have to check into that.
Well, environmental news this month was mainly dominated by the Waukesha decision. We will revisit and update that here in a minute with you. But first, I'd like to talk about another story that got less attention, at least on our program. Just last week, President Obama signed into law a pipeline safety reauthorization bill that reportedly contains higher safety standards that will impact Enbridge's Line 5 running through the Mackinac Straits. What can you tell us about these higher standards?
Sure, Mark. This is an important piece of legislation primarily spearheaded by the two Michigan senators, Senator Debbie Stabenow and especially Senator Gary Peters. So props to them. There are basically three improved standards for the Great Lakes. The first one designates the lakes as what is called a high consequence area, which holds the operators of these pipelines, in this case primarily Enbridge, to a higher operating standard. The second one requires a response, cleanup plans, I should say, in the event of a spill under ice, which is obvious for the Straits of Mackinac. You know, it's kind of like, hello, the Straits of Mackinac freeze over, and, you know, nobody had a plan for what to do when they're covered by a foot of ice. So that's in the legislation. And then lastly, it requires more attention to be paid to old pipelines, aged pipelines, which is currently applicable to the Straits pipeline, which is 60 years old. So these are improvements to the status quo, but it's also important to note that they're sort of reactive, you know, kind of focusing a bit on what happens after a spill versus the bigger issue of do we keep this pipeline in place or not.
Was there any response from Enbridge to this?
Well, sure. Enbridge released what I would call its standard statement regarding the Straits of Mackinac pipeline, which is to say that it has run safely for over 60 years. And, of course, they will comply with the law, which is what you would expect.
Any response from now? Was the Snyder administration supportive of the pipeline safety reauthorization bill and these reforms that you just referred to?
In general, yes. I didn't see anything specific from the Snyder administration or from the Department of Environmental Quality. But over the last few years, when this has been an issue, Governor Snyder has long held that pipeline safety is primarily a federal responsibility. So I'm sure that he welcomes these improvements. And I'd also say that, you know, the governor's response to the whole pipeline issue with the Straits of Mackinac, you know, was featured in a study released by Attorney General Bill Schuette and former Department of Environmental Quality Director Dan Wyatt last year. And that was the primary finding there, was that no tar sand crude oil should flow through that pipeline. It doesn't now, and Enbridge has said it won't. So to date, the governor has still been loath to use the gravitas of his office to try to effect change, which would be either a shutdown or a replacement of that pipeline. Mm-hmm. So we'll see how he kind of stands on the sidelines.
We're talking with Great Lakes journalist and commentator Gary Wilson. This is the Great Lakes Month in Review here on WKAR's Current State. Last week, we discussed civil charges brought by Attorney General Bill Schuette against a couple of corporations involved in the Flint water crisis, related to the water crisis. And this follows criminal charges previously announced against state and Flint employees. But you've been tracking investigations into the Flint crisis at the federal level, which we have talked about less. Remind us what's going on in those federal investigations.
Sure, Mark. At the same time last January that Attorney General Schuette launched his investigation, the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, the Office of the Inspector General, launched an investigation into the EPA's role in Flint, what I'll call the Flint water debacle, sort of writ large. And it's important to remember that the EPA has and had direct oversight responsibility under the Safe Drinking Water for what happened in Flint. And it's also important for everybody to remember that in October of 2015, when the lead problem was publicly known and the issue was getting a lot of scrutiny, Flint citizens formally petitioned the EPA to use its emergency authority to intervene in Flint. EPA kind of slow-walked its response, not getting back to Flint citizens until December. And then they declined to intervene, saying essentially that the MDEQ was on the problem. And then when the whole issue blew up in January, the regional administrator, Susan Hedman, resigned. That's when the EPA Inspector General sent a team to Flint. But we've heard nothing since. And I contacted the EPA IG's office for a status report, and I got a "we don't comment on investigations" response. I followed up, and they've now sent me to the Justice Department office in Detroit. So that'll be my next stop. Hmm.
EPA IG, that's Inspector General?
Yes, sir.
Okay, very good. Now, here's the thing. With most of the blame falling on and accepted by the Snyder administration over Flint, why is it important to have an investigation by the EPA?
Well, the EPA is still very highly involved in Flint today. So if there were systemic failures, they should be known. And the people there should be held accountable, just as people in Michigan were. And EPA Administrator Gina McCarthy now has, since January, and as recently as the past couple of weeks, fired off, you know, very direct letters to Governor Snyder and Flint Mayor Karen Weaver, telling them what she thinks they should be doing related to the operation of Flint's water system right now. So this is the same Administrator McCarthy that was there when this whole system broke down. So I think there needs to be equal accountability between the EPA and the state of Michigan. Mm.
Finally, let's briefly revisit the Waukesha decision, again, in favor of drawing water from Lake Michigan for this community on the edge of the Great Lakes Basin. When you add up, here you've had a week to think about this and process all of these various responses, Gary, positive and negative. What do you take away from this whole process and the decision?
Well, I think, you know, people are post-decision. The responses were along predictable lines. If you were for the diversion before, you were happy with the decision. If you were against it, you were unhappy. I would just add that the environmental groups, especially the ones in Michigan, are a little bit more circumspect. Prior to the decision, they were steadfastly against the diversion, but on reflection, they've come around and have been what I would call softly supportive of it, with the caveat that they'll be monitoring for enforcement.
There have been some complaints from those environmental groups, though, a mayor's organization and others, about a lack of inclusion and transparency in the process. Are those claims warranted?
I don't believe they are, Mark. I've been tracking this thing closely for a number of years. There have been public comment sessions. People have been able to comment over the Internet, via email. All of the meetings that led to the decision over the past couple of months that supported the decision were open to the public. You could attend and actually watch changes being made. So I just think those lack of transparency allegations ring hollow. I don't believe they're warranted.
We want to thank Gary Wilson, Great Lakes journalist and commentator here. Our Great Lakes Month in Review is a monthly feature here on WKAR's Current State. Gary, we'll check back in the end of July, if not sooner. Thank you.
Thanks, Mark.
Current State on 90.5 WKAR. We've got another Current State pop-up stories event coming up tomorrow evening where volunteer storytellers share their true first-person stories on a given theme. Now, to get us in the storytelling mood for tomorrow evening, we're going to listen to a story from our last event just a month ago at the Robin Theater in Rio Town, where the theme was the birds and the bees. Storyteller Sarah Kwilinski told this story about the experience of explaining the birds and bees to her three-year-old.
When our oldest son was about 3 1/2, we learned we were going to have another baby. And so we would have to tell him another baby is coming to the house. And being the modern mother that I am, I, of course, immediately went online, researched all the mommy blogs, how do you tell your three-year-old about the birds and the bees? And found some reassuring advice. They said, first of all, just say it simply, and then let the child ask questions. And as the child leads the conversation, age-appropriate language, and honestly, it's a three-year-old. How long is their attention span? This will be a short conversation. Well, that was great advice. I could do that. So, it's midsummer. I'm about 6 months pregnant, laying on the couch one day, shorts, tank top, and my son's playing there on the floor, and I said to him, hey, honey, guess what? Mama's gonna have a baby. Well, his eyes got really bright. Because the thing that I didn't think about is the fact that our son was not your average 3 1/2-year-old. He liked information. He liked really technical, deeply precise information. He started asking questions. He asked so many questions, I think we covered the entire human sexuality and reproductive curriculum for the public schools. At three. I think I could have opted him out for all the other sex ed class. He's already got it. He's done. But I kept plugging away, because after all, I am the mom who says, if my kid has a question, I will find an answer for you. So it's been at least a half an hour. And the other thing you should know about my son is that even at 3 1/2, he already knew what he wanted to be when he grew up. Most other kids in preschool wanted to be a fireman or a teacher. He, at 3 1/2, said, I would like to grow up to be an illustrator of mathematical textbooks. Fast forward 10 years, he actually has won awards in art and math, so he really did know he was on that path. But going back to that time, he asks many, many questions, and there I am lying on the couch, and he kind of has wrapped up his question time. And he steps back, and he looks at me, starts at my feet, gazes up to my head, back to the belly, pauses, up to the head, back to the belly, down. He's really looking at me. And I could tell the artistic side of his mind was really spinning. And he's thinking and thinking, and all of a sudden he gets this look of discovery, and he's so happy, and he says, Mama, I see it. What do you see? And he points to my belly, and he says, there's the baby's head. I'm like, sure, yeah, honey, that's probably the head. Then he moves upward. He has noticed that Mama's upper half looks a little different than non-pregnant Mama's upper half used to look. And he says, and look, I even see the feet with the big toes sticking up. You can probably imagine the technical illustration that my very artistic son drew in the finger paints at preschool the next day.
Our next pop-up stories event is tomorrow night at Allen Marketplace in Lansing. The theme is Putting Down Roots, 5:30 to 7 p.m. We've got a full lineup of storytellers for this event, but we hope to see you there in the audience for a night of great first-person storytelling. For more information, check out our Facebook page, Pop-Up Stories Lansing. For over a quarter century, Carolyn Sherrill has led the Meridian Community Band in Okemos. Current State's Jamie Paisley met with the maestro at her open house this past weekend, where she celebrated 26 years with that ensemble, which has a wide assortment of skill levels among its members.
For those that don't know, what is the Meridian Community Band and who comprises the members of that?
The Meridian Community Band is a 90-member amateur ensemble made up of multi-generational people, students, high school aged up through people who might be 85 years old, representing all walks of life.
And though you've been with it for 26 years, the history predates to the 70s, I believe, as well.
Yes, from what I understand, back at the bicentennial in 1976, Virginia White from the Meridian Township wanted a band at the celebration. And people enjoyed that so much, then there was an effort to start a community band. And so the band got started, from what I understand, in 1977. And I've been the director since 1990.
The members of the Meridian Community Band are across all ages. And there's something about, are the people that they've wanted to, or did they study music, or just the love of music brings people to the Meridian Band?
The love of music is what brings people to the band, people who enjoy that special spark that happens when people work together toward a common cause. And so we have a range of people with maybe advanced middle school level talent up through people with doctorates in music who play in the band. I even have two of my music ed professors at Michigan State, Dave Catron and Bob Urbis, who have played in the band for many, many years. And so you have this wide range of musical talent.
Just to clarify, they were your professors at MSU?
They were. Bob Urbis was the chairperson of the music ed department at Michigan State when I was a student. And David Catron is the conductor emeritus of the Spartan Marching Band. And when I first came to Michigan State as a transfer student in 1979, he also had come to MSU, which was his second time at MSU. But I played in his band, and I played in his band for several years.
1979. So if my timeline is right, 10 years later, then you took over the Meridian Band. Is that about right?
10 years later, I started playing in the band as a clarinetist. I was on maternity leave, and I was actually bored being a stay-at-home mother. And I actually had never played in a community band before. And so I wanted to be able to get out of the house. And it was a lot of fun. That next summer, the current director left, and I was on the board, and I raised my hand and said, well, I'll volunteer. I'll be the interim director. And that lasted for 26 years.
How do you then choose the repertoire that you do?
Choosing repertoire is actually one of my favorite things to do. I love choosing repertoire. My father used to ask me when I was a child why I was playing all these boring scales, and I wouldn't be a real clarinetist until I could play the clarinet polka. And so I think that as a director, I try to take a balance of picking music that I think I would like as the director, selecting music that the musicians would enjoy playing and would maybe stretch them at times. And also you have to keep in mind who you are playing for. For any given concert, are you playing for nursing home residents, or are you playing for other musicians, or are you playing for the general public? And so you need to select music that represents that. And in addition to that, you have to think about pacing of the music that you pick. You can't have everything at the same tempo or duple meter or the same key signature. And I love, it's like putting together a jigsaw puzzle to put all the pieces together in a program so that it's satisfying for the audience and the musicians alike.
Now, as you were talking about having concerts for the public at large, you've got, as part of your farewell tour, if you will, three concerts in about a week and a half, all kind of tied, I believe, to Independence Day that's coming up.
The theme of our concert is America Forever, and our first concert is this Wednesday at the Lebowski Center in Owosso, starting at 7:30. On Friday, we're performing at the Lake Lansing Bandshell at 7 o'clock, and then on Thursday, July 7th, the band will be performing at McCormick Park in Williamston.
And I'm assuming there will be a significant amount of John Philip Sousa in that program.
Indeed, many of our pieces, probably 12 out of 18, are patriotic in nature. And we have, of course, the Stars and Stripes Forever. Another one of Sousa's marches is the Invincible Eagle that we're doing. Sousa is, of course, one of my favorite composers. I've played in Keith Bryan's new Sousa band, which tours nationally since about the early 2000s. And so I have a keen interest in Sousa's brand of showmanship, which Arthur Fiedler copied, by the way, blending the classics with marches and light music.
Speaking with Maestro Carolyn Sherrill, who is stepping down from her 26 years with the Meridian Band. And for the Meridian Band itself, there's a lot of the adult learner that you're working with. But in addition, you also have a position in the Lansing area with, I believe, an elementary and middle school. You're not retiring from them either, are you?
I am not retiring from my school job. I teach at Lansing St. Gerard School and teach elementary through middle school band grades 5 through 8.
So when you have your daytime position and you have the young learner of musical instruments, how is the transition of turning on a dime on Wednesday nights when you go to the Meridian Band rehearsals?
Oh, that's a good question, because quite often I think that the adults are very much like middle school students in aging bodies. So the music is harder with the adults. But there are a lot of similarities, actually, more than you may ever guess.
You don't have to tell them to practice long tones for forever and ever.
I do. I probably pretty much try to use things as a teachable moment, because, again, you have this wide range of skills, and some people maybe haven't learned how to practice, or they haven't had private lessons to advance their technique, for example, trying to show them ways to practice a difficult passage, or that they don't have to play every note on the page. If it's too hard for them, there's nothing wrong with sitting out for a measure or two and coming back in.
Currently, the Meridian Band is in the process of finding your replacement. That process is ongoing, but for whoever that is, do you have any suggestions to either them, or if you want to phrase it in a different way, what advice would you give to yourself 26 years ago, so as you were about to start?
Well, picking the music is very, very important. That's critical, because you're going to attract audiences that way. But it's also really important to be very interested in the people you're with and try to get to know them and think about people first, music second.
Maestro Carolyn Sherrill, thanks again for speaking with us. More information about the three concerts coming up, the America Forever concerts in various parts across Mid-Michigan, you can find online at meridiancommunityband.org. For Current State, I'm Jamie Paisley.
And that's our show for today. Glad you could join us. Tomorrow on Current State, last year, Lansing City Pulse reporter Todd Haywood was assaulted and robbed in his home, targeted because he's gay. Haywood writes about the attack in City Pulse this week, and Current State will talk with him about the story. Plus, you might not think Mad Max and fighting cancer would ever be related in any way, but in Lake Odessa they are. Thunder on the Grand is a nonprofit that raises money for young cancer patients in Michigan by throwing a huge annual event. This year's theme is Mad About Cancer, with Mad Max-inspired activities like a rodeo, parade, and golf cart racing, and lots more. We'll find out all about it in our Neighbors in Action segment here tomorrow. That's Wednesday on Current State. The executive producer of Current State is Peter Worf. Kevin Lavery directed our show today. Thanks also to Scott Pohl, Jamie Paisley, Katie Cook, Brooke Allen, and to Drew Hill for engineering. Remember the Current State podcast, your informative, insightful, and indispensable connection with what's happening around mid-Michigan and beyond. We cover all the bases, politics, education from around the state, your hometown, everything is there. The Current State podcast, anywhere, anytime at iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you get quality podcasts. Pop-up stories tomorrow evening. Putting Down Roots is our storyteller's theme. At the Allen Marketplace on the east side of Lansing, join us between 5:30 and 7 p.m. And stay connected with Current State on Twitter, at KAR Current State. On Facebook, we're at Current State from WKAR. Thank you for joining us today. We'll see you tomorrow.